I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Listen in as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them. If you've ever driven along U.S. 40 on the eastern edge of Terre Haute, you've witnessed history in the form of a billboard. It's not just any billboard, though. For over 80 years, it's featured a working clock and an iconic image familiar to bakers everywhere, that of Clabber Girl Baking Powder. The corporation is headquartered in Terre Haute, and the 44-foot-long billboard dates back to the 1930s, when then-company owner Tony Holman, yes, that Holman family of Indianapolis Motor Speedway fame, developed a national sales campaign that included roadside billboards. In 2017, Rose Holman Institute of Technology took ownership of the sign when the school purchased over 1,000 acres of nearby land from the Holman family, and that included the southwest corner of U.S. 40 and Hunt Road, where the infamous Clabber Girl billboard sits. As you can imagine, 80 years of Indiana weather can do some damage. So as part of the purchase, Rose Holman decided to restore the landmark. They hired Terre Haute artist Becky Hochalter to do the work. So I drove to campus and spent the afternoon with her as she worked in a large garage restoring the beloved billboard.
My name is Becky Hochalter, and I'm a professional artist. I do actually about anything that's related to art. I do digital illustrations, magazine illustrations. I do portraits. I do a lot of commission paintings, murals. I actually do a lot of work for Rose Holman.
My name is Robert Coons. I'm the president of Rose Holman. We've had a long and positive relationship with the Holman family. They've been extremely supportive since our founding, and that landmark is an important part of that, and it's been there for many, many years. It means a lot to this community. I think it's extremely important that we acknowledge our heritage and that we make sure that our local community feels like Rose Holman is a part of it as well, and so I think this is a nice way to demonstrate that.
The panels were actually taken down by the sign company, and so they were more in charge of what was going on with the frame and the panels. Anything that could be saved was saved. It wasn't, you know, it's an over 80-year-old sign.
Where have you gone to find the colors that existed then? Do they exist now? I mean, I know mm-hmm. there's a lot of hunting and gathering that goes into this process
right.
before you even start painting.
Right. There's a lot of research. I went to Clabber Girl and Holman & Company. And for colors, they actually have loaned me a metal sign from the 1930s. Hasn't seen the light of day for I can't tell you how many years, so the color should be very accurate to what it was. Still wrapped in paper and cardboard. It's a new sign. So that, for color accuracy, is very good, and I'm blending my colors to that sign. Image-wise, the main image came from photos of the billboard, but the image on the can, the Clabber Girl illustration, kind of shows, you know, what they would consider the Clabber Girl with her plate of biscuits and things going on in the background in a looks like a cabin setting. That image also came from Clabber Girl, and they provided a larger printed version of that so that I could be more accurate with that. It has been maybe more of a line art version in the past. My intention is to make it more true to the Clabber Girl illustration that is on the can of Clabber Girl baking powder. So it is more of a realistic rendition of that image, and that is what I'm going to restore it to. The panels were brought to me by the sign company, so I have primed the panels. And my process always is to start with a computer layout because I'm a computer graphics person. So I usually do a scale image on the computer, and I We'll draw a grid on there that represents a 1 foot by 1 foot grid. Then I draw the grid on the panels, and anything that's in each square on my layout then is drawn by hand in those squares on the billboard.
We have quite an art collection here that we've amassed over a number of years. And this is another way to look at that, another type of art and design that really creates another experience for not only the community, but our students as well.
So many people look at that billboard, and I know that Rose Holman realized the importance of the billboard to the community, but I don't think they realized until they started this project how many people look at that sign. I mean, there's an elementary school across the street from that sign, and they use it to dismiss their buses every day, the clock on the sign. They know if it's accurate, and they use it every day. It's, like I said, it's an iconic Terre Haute image. And even though it just seems like it's just an advertisement, obviously it means a lot to the people of Terre Haute for that to be restored.
Since my visit with Becky, she finished the billboard, and it's back on US 40, greeting motorists and keeping school kids on time. Each week, we feature a local DIY or do-it-yourself artist who is making it. This week, Curious Mix contributor Chris Siegel introduces us to an educator and performer named Jeremiah Barnes. Barnes is also known as Mossy Stone, the literate drag queen, and host of monthly book readings for kids at Indy Reads on Mass Ave in downtown Indianapolis.
Hello, 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 everybody. How are you? That was not very loud. We got to wake up on Saturday morning. How are you?
I was living in Bismarck, North Dakota. I was finishing my degree, and I was in the military. And if you've never been to North Dakota, it is bitterly cold. And I am a Southern boy, and I spent 2 years in school full-time, living in a basement, and was alone most of the time. And the way I kept my spirits up was through creating Mossy Stone.
Yeah. Yeah, we gotta shake off the burr. Are you ready? Give me one of these. On the count of three. Ready? 1, 2, 3. All right. Did y'all have a good
I was reading a poem by William Wordsworth where he describes his lover as a violet on a mossy stone. And the point of the poem is that his lover was this person who was kind of off the beaten path and nobody really knew she existed. But he said that, you know, she meant all the world to him. And here I was living alone in North Dakota trying to find my way back home. And I think I just wanted somebody to feel that way about me. And it also kind of at the time sounded like a Bond girl. So I decided to try it out.
Well, let's kick this party off, shall we? The first book that we are going to read is a perfect.
When I moved to Indianapolis and I got out of the Air Force, I began looking for places in the city where I could combine literacy and drag. And when I came into this bookstore, Indy Reads Books, on Mass Ave here in Indianapolis, I tell you what, it blew my mind. I instantly fell in love with the room and the building and the people here. We became friends, and I literally, like, started emailing them, and I was like, hey, I'm new to town, I'm doing drag, could I read stories to kids? And so they said yes, and here we are.
Tomorrow, I'll be adventurous. I'll play, and I'll explore. I'll make or learn or try something I've never done before.
I'm a preacher's kid and a military brat. And then I served in the military. And so for me, service has always been kind of just in my bones. And when I'm not actively volunteering or doing something, then I don't feel normal. Like, I'm not me. I mean, it takes me 2 hours to get into makeup, right? When you're staring at your own face for that long and absorbed in yourself for that long, you need to turn your face towards other people and love on them. You know, you need to make it about other people. I'm an elementary school teacher by day, and so I know that when you're watching the kids, if they start shifting in their chairs or whispering to their mom, it's like their attention's getting low. So we got to fill their attention tank back up.
All right, everybody on your feet.
Ready? Ready,
I love the after part where I get to talk to people. And I have families that come in and they are they're walking through their own journey of sexual or gender identity. And they come to me and they talk and they're like, you know, you're a guy in a dress. And that blurs our culture's lines of what's normal. And I think these are the spaces, these are the moments where people can come in and take that weight and that shame off and really look at themselves through eyes that are loving and give themselves a chance to consider who they are.
I don't really expect her to remember anything specific, but just more so the idea of we go out and do this as a family.
I think she's just here to, you know, hear a good story, get some dancing in, and, you know, just look at all the interesting people here.
I think events like these are important to show different gender identities and just interact with people in a way that's more at her level. She may not remember it specifically, what she did here, but the value that you take from it is going to go with you for the rest of your life.
I think any opportunity to kind of show our kids the beautiful diversity of life is a good thing as well. My son is 6. He's one of the older kids here, but he still seems to really enjoy it.
I like when they read the funny books. It's just the best thing I've ever heard.
I think kids sometimes just are looking for permission from grown-ups to be kids. They're looking for permission to put the tablet and the phone down and the TV down and go do something with their minds, go do something intellectually stimulating. I think that books have almost become novelty, and so for kids, I want to turn that around. I always want to impress upon them the importance of loving themselves. And that looks like something. That's not just a feeling. That's practical. How do you love yourself? If you mess up on a test at school, you don't say to yourself, oh, I'm stupid. You say, I'll do better next time. I try harder. Self-talk is a big one. I try to encourage them to embrace their creativity. And I also insist upon them reading a book. When I leave Drag Queen Story Hour, if the kids have walked away with any of those messages, then I know I did my job.
For Curious Mix, I'm Chris Siegel.
Still to come on Curious Mix, hoaxes.
By the time I saw him on television, Stan the Man Stasiak, master of the heart punch, had become an old man.
And happenings.
We were going out as Joe Cocker's roadies came in on his equipment truck. But as I understand it, Joe Cocker never played. He never even showed up at the event.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. The rapper and producer Diop's new album called Still Shinin' was created as a way to cope with the trauma that he experienced after the unexpected death of his ex-girlfriend and her daughter. Curious Mix contributor Kyle Long talks with the Indianapolis-based musician.
Trauma can fuel creativity. I think that needs to be more explicit as a tool for healing.
Living life without a mask, no mirage, no facade. This is who I am, to the core. Wear my feelings on my face, face my feelings every day. I'm just hunting with my pack, strategize and make a way. I came up with many who didn't make it past 25. I'm still alive at dirty 30. I strive to ball like Clyde and James Worthy. Mix the grind with the grind, I've been worthy. What it seems, life's ripping at the seams. Crushing people's hope, got them aborting their dreams. Plan B becomes A for most. They brag and boast, yelling out they have arrived. You didn't follow your dreams, that's a disease. Keep going and flowing like you the sea. Living life on your terms and you will see. If you want it, it's theirs.
My ex-girl and her daughter passed, and that happened last year. And it really shook me up, because I, you know, you're never prepared to deal with death or someone transitioning. And when you do, depending on your behaviors or everything else that's going on in your life, you have to be critical on how you're going to handle it. And for me, I had fortunately just built a studio in my basement and started producing. So I took a lot of that energy and that weight and poured it into my art. And while I was doing that, I was trying to create art that reflected my mood. And I ended up with the album Still Shining.
Community showing up that we don't need anything that they got, but they still owe us everything. Being past due, collect leveraging checks and respect whether they like it or not. We occupying a spot and teaching our children to do the same. Every year grow, don't move the same. Even when they say that you insane, invest in your people, remove the chains. Remove the chains. Yeah. Invest in your people, remove the chains. Yeah.
When we're feeling a certain way, we can go and pick a song or a color or a movie that we think describes that mood. So since I was producing and being a sample-based producer starting out, I would go and pick samples or sounds that I thought spoke to how I was feeling that day or that week. And then I would structure my songwriting and my emotion and my tone to reflect that, so then I can look back and hear it and see if I accomplished that. And the funny part is, when I first started doing it, it wasn't even conscious. It was just, this is how I'm feeling today, I'm gonna go home, I'm gonna play this. Oh, okay, can I sample this? Can I find something that has this same tone and sample it? Then can I create something that reflects how I'm feeling? Which I feel like help with dealing with it, but also I feel like the better I can do that, the better I can paint feelings and paint emotions through my music, which then can really connect and impact the spirit. I think by keeping myself occupied, but not removing my mind from what I was dealing with, allowed me to look at it, but not feel like I was sitting still or running in place. And then to be able to take that and allow the world to use it however they may, and hopefully it impacts others in similar ways or inspires others to do something similar when they're feeling like they're struggling, I think is invaluable and priceless. You know, when they talk about growing or growth, it's like stress. You know, stress can stimulate growth, but it can also stimulate death. So if we want to stick around and we want to be able to provide and be the best we can be, we have to find ways to stimulate growth and deal with stress. That I feel like continually provides that opportunity for others. So the way in which you're dealing with something is also teaching someone else how to do it and how to deal with it, whether right or wrong. So if we can be intentional about healing and our approaches to healing, those that watch us can take on those same behaviors and impact their life and others. So yeah, I feel like, and if you can do that, then you're investing in yourself and you're providing an opportunity for you to continue to commit to being here and contribute while being here, which is still shining. You know you think it's great, nice.
the power of music was in full force in August of 1969 at Woodstock. For 3 days, some of the world's biggest names in rock and roll played on an outdoor stage to an audience estimated to be over 400,000 people. A similar gathering took place over Labor Day weekend in 1972 in Indiana, at a place along the lower Wabash River, known then and now as Bull Island. Curious Mix contributor Gary Harrison tells us more about this Hoosier Woodstock.
Hell yeah, it's over there.
Let me introduce you to John Farmer.
I went over Friday morning and come back Monday morning.
John was just a teenager back in 1972. And, being a red-blooded, proud product of the lower Wabash River Valley, he sure as heck wasn't going to let the Hoosier Woodstock happen without him.
Oh, yeah, I was prepared to go to that sucker, boy. I was ready. I took off a week's work to go to that.
The bad news is, John passed away a few years ago. The good news is, before he died, he was kind enough to let us record his memories about being there at Bull Island.
Me and a friend of mine, we had a blast. Yeah, it was really something.
I have never been in a crowd that large before or since.
This is Randy Starks.
It was a huge crowd, bigger than I can remember at the Indianapolis 500. You know, I've seen estimates up to 300,000. I don't know.
Randy Starks is a lifelong Hoosier who makes his home in Indianapolis. Randy's approaching retirement now, but back in 1972...
I was 23.
Back in 1972, there was no way 23-year-old Randy Starks could not get in his car.
I drove a 69 Camaro then.
And point that 69 Camaro south and then west so that he would hit the bullseye, Indiana's biggest rock and roll show ever, Bull Island.
The bands, the lineup was so fantastic that, you know, you couldn't pass it up.
It's supposed to have been like 30 bands, you know.
There's one more gentleman I'd like you to meet. Dick Wallsmith.
My name's Dick Wallsmith, and I'm from Frankfort, Indiana.
Dick's another guy contemplating the joys of retirement now, things like Social Security and Medicare. But back Labor Day weekend 1972...
I was 22.
Yes, Labor Day weekend 1972, Social Security and Medicare weren't anywhere near being on Dick's radar screen. No, what the 22-year-old Dick Wallsmith was thinking about back then was the enormous list of talent soon to appear on the Bull Island stage.
The rumors were going around that Black Sabbath was going to play, Rod Stewart and the Faces, Black Oak, Joe Cocker, Albert King, Foghat, Ted Nugent, Cheech and Chong, and Pure Prairie League, you know, The Doors, all of those bands.
I'm not sure what kind of a crowd these bands could draw today, but back in 1972, the idea of seeing these bands and a couple dozen more like them all together at one big festival had the potential to draw an enormous crowd. Here's Randy Starks again.
You know, we wanted it to be the Hoosier Woodstock. The whole idea there was that it was, you know, Woodstock had happened a couple of years earlier. And anyway, we wanted this whole thing to be like the Hoosier version of that. And, of course, it kind of fit in with a joke we used to have about how things come to Indiana a little later than they do on the coast.
No matter. All across the Midwest, people were loading up their cars and trucks and minivans, just like Dick Wallsmith.
There was 12 of us total, and we caravaned down, left a day early. I had a 71 Volkswagen Squareback with the back seat folded down so you could sleep in it, and we had it packed with as much food and alcohol as we could possibly carry.
The spirit of free enterprise was there in full force that weekend at Bull Island.
You could buy anything you wanted there, I'll tell you that for sure.
There were several tents set up openly making money in interesting ways, not necessarily legal.
There's so many illegal things going on, you know. If you smoked pot, there was plenty of pot. If you did anything beyond that, there was all kinds of stuff going on. Anything that you wanted was pretty much there. The people that parked right next to us, in fact, they opened their trunk and it was a drugstore. There was a lot of acid there. And of course they had people talking on the PA, you know. The brown acid is not particularly good, you know, I mean, just like at Woodstock.
That's a reference to the famous line in the movie Woodstock that the brown acid circulating around us is not, specifically, too good.
We felt like we were at our own little Woodstock.
There were virtually no police. It was just unmanaged, unwatched. Although, I'm sure they were watching. We just didn't see them.
But lest we forget and get too wrapped up in what was happening in the audience at our own little Woodstock, let's remember what brought these hundreds of thousands of people to Bull Island in the first place.
Really and truly, you know, one of the main things I went over there for mainly was the music. Different bands that was going to be there.
It was quite a lineup. And of course, as we know now, many of those bands never played there. Many of them never even showed up. And of course, you wonder how many of them were actually booked, too. So.
Yes, sad to say, Black Sabbath, Rod Stewart, The Doors, and a whole lot of other big names either never really were going to be there in the first place, or were going to play, but backed out.
We heard this story that the Faces and The Doors were both in town in Evansville, but that they had both left because there was some billing problem as to who was going to play first and all that sort of thing, you know, and it probably had a lot more to do with money or something, I'm not sure. And when we left, we were going out as Joe Cocker's roadies came in on his equipment truck. But as I understand it, Joe Cocker never played. He never even showed up at the event, like many bands. I think from a promoter's point of view, it was less peace and love and a little bit more greed than anything else.
Of course, not every band advertised didn't show up.
The only one that really stuck out was Ravi Shankar. It's an Indian band.
Ravi Shankar, he's got bragging rights. He can say that he was there at Bull Island.
Second day was opened by Ravi Shankar. You know, you wake up in the morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, there's just like sitars and tambas and stuff just whizzing around. It's like, who is that? It could only be Ravi Shankar, you know. At 7 o'clock, the following band came on, and it was Ted Nugent. He said, "Get up, you mothers," you know. But it was an excellent way to start the morning.
Groups like Black Sabbath and Gentle Giant, who was touring with Black Sabbath at the time, if you go to their websites, you find that they both claim that they played, but the other one didn't.
Meanwhile, how do you keep 300,000 music fans upset by one no-show after another from rioting and tearing down the stage? Float out the rumor of a mystery guest. We can't say who exactly, but it's one of the three or four biggest rock and roll acts ever. And they're set to start playing any minute now.
We heard throughout the day that there was a mystery guest anticipated. And of course, a lot of names flew around. Now, the names that I kept hearing were Bob Dylan or George Harrison. Those were the ones that kept coming up, you know, and surfacing.
Yes, there was supposedly going to be a mystery guest. And it was, the rumor we heard was going to be Mick Jagger, but it never happened.
No one seemed to be in charge. And as I have learned now years later, the promoters never even showed up on the island after the first day. They were probably long gone.
Some historians over the years have turned up their noses at Bull Island, the Hoosier Woodstock, and proclaimed it an enormous, mud-soaked logistical nightmare. Nothing but bad planning, bad execution, and performers who didn't show up. In other words, a complete, chaotic disaster. But that's not how John Farmer, Randy Starks, and Dick Wallsmith see it, for the most part.
You know, I don't think it was a disaster because it... I don't know if all the statistics ever come out on it or not, really. There you hear different stories about this and that and other about... Oh, the other day, somebody was talking about the other day, said there was 8, 10, 12 people killed over there, this and that and other. Well, you know, hell.
For all the things that were happening around me that could have been really bad, you know, you look back and say, well, it was an experience, and I'm really glad that I went.
I just would like to say that, you know, that was an excellent opportunity to have a good time with a lot of people you didn't know. We expected Woodstock, and it was very close.
For Curious Mix, I'm Gary Harrison.
Thank you.
just ahead on Curious Mix, keeping things in perspective.
They said that I was too commercial or people weren't buying funny stuff, and I'd never seen anything funny in a gallery anyway.
And perky.
Chili sauce, chili powder, lime, and then we add the tamarind stick.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. Phoenix Rising is the resident dance company of the Phoenix Theater in Indianapolis. The company specializes in work that is current and edgy. Curious Mix contributor Bob Williams sat down with the husband and husband team who co-founded and direct the company, William and Justin Sears Watson, to learn how it came to be and where it plans to go.
When Justin was with Dance Kaleidoscope, he and I put a little something together that was kind of a, we would perform for benefits or charity things or the mayor's luncheon or something like that. And so we would get a group of people together and put something together and then do it. And it just was a way when he was off contract to have something to do. We used a lot of DK dancers. It was just, more than anything, it was fun. So in 2015, he suffered a couple of stress fractures. And being an older dancer at the time, it took a while to heal. And we decided after a long time it was time to retire. And during that time, we were building Phoenix Rising Dance Studios. And we thought, you know, let's get serious about the dance company.
What makes this company so special?
The diversity in the company, and not just in race, but in background, in education, in, you know, where these dancers come from. We don't use necessarily the same cast every single show.
Justin, you're a former DK dancer.
Yes, I am.
What makes Phoenix Rising special? What sets you apart in the dance community?
What sets us apart is that we are striving to be the voice for current events, political views, social, economic, being able to use dance as an art form to make all of those things that need to be talked about and discussed palatable so that people can begin to have conversations. And so when you present it in the form of dance, people tend to be a lot more vulnerable. They tend to connect their emotion to the issues that are at hand. At the same time, we also have to be able to mix that and make and entertain people as well. Otherwise, we kind of aren't going to get people in the seats, right? So,
Andre Williams, you have been with the company since the very beginning and are now the rehearsal director. Tell me what being a part of Phoenix Rising has meant to you artistically.
Artistically, it's really forced me to grow in a lot of ways that I didn't expect to. Now I also have like an independent guard. I do a lot of choreography outside of Phoenix as well as in the studio. I think it's made me a stronger choreographer, a stronger designer and artist myself, because Justin really just asked us to be a little bit more open and vulnerable in the process of creating. So it kind of forces you out of your box of your everyday life and into like this space where you're completely free. And I feel like there's a lot of room to create and to grow from there.
Where do you go from here? Where does the company go from here, in your opinion?
The sky is the limit. I feel like we have a dance studio, we have a dance company. You know, we're wanting to tour, we're wanting to become a bigger name in Indianapolis, which I feel like we already are now. So who knows?
And just like that, another reason to go to the Phoenix Theater. That's not a bad thing. For Curious Mix, this is Bob Williams.
It's time to perk up our palates with a little help from Yelp, the online community of ordinary eaters who know the tastiest places in town to go when it comes to ethnic eats. If you want to satisfy your sweet tooth with an authentic Mexican treat, they suggest the Mangonada at Danny's Mexican Ice Cream.
My name is Angel, but everybody calls me Danny. The name of the business is Danny's Mexican Ice Cream. We are going to make the Mangonada today. It's a really popular dessert in Mexico, so kind of where we really got the inspiration from. The Mangonada is 2 scoops of mango sorbet, fresh mango pieces, chili sauce and the chili powder, and we top it off with lime, and then it's a tamarind stick to finish it off. We start off with a cup. We pour chili sauce around the cup and then chili powder around the cup as well. We scoop a scoop of mango sorbet on the cup, then we add mango pieces, more chili sauce, more chili powder, and then we add another scoop of mango sorbet, and then we pre with chili sauce, chili powder, lime, and then we add the tamarind stick. Best way to enjoy it would be just like on a hot summer day, it was just like with a spoon.
Danny's Mexican Ice Cream is located at 7730 East U.S. Highway 36 in Avon. How does a poem inspire a visual artist? Like this. Here's Curious Mix contributor Terry Border.
The book is called The Dead Wrestler Elegies by W. Todd Kaneko. And the whole book is poems about professional wrestling. I enjoyed the Andre the Giant book, a poem so much I had to get the book. And his feelings for professional wrestling really grew from his father. That was what the time they shared together was. They didn't have a lot in common. But the son, W. Todd Kaneko, would obviously sit down and watch all these wrestlers with his dad. And they had a strange relationship, but this was the time they shared. And so he wrote poems about when I was a kid in the 70s, I remember seeing Dick the Bruiser on Channel 4 here in Indianapolis. And it has a poem about Dick the Bruiser, which was really good. But the poem I picked is called Stan Stasiak Was World Champion for 9 Days. By the time I saw him on television, Stan the Man Stasiak, master of the heart punch, had become an old man. My father balanced his 6th Budweiser on his belly, lamented those days when Stasiak fought Pedro Morales for the gold, as we watched him lumbering about the ring, a grizzly bear wearing mutton chops and a temper laced with kerosene. He was the oldest grappler in Portland, ancient hands aching to stop a young man's heart with a solitary fist. That old guy was once on top, my father said, staring on a spot on some wall that crumbled years ago. My father snorted and closed his eyes, laid there for a few minutes, while old Stasiak clubbed his younger foe a series of slow blows, elbow smash, left hook, haymaker. The television audience cheered him on. My father's can tipped into his lap, beer swirling between his legs and into the sofa. He shook his head, eyed me without even looking at me. He was the world champion. The television seethed with evil wrestlers swarming the ring, boots and fists to Stasiak's battered body. My father laughed and shook his fist at the television, a beer-soaked whisper. Men like us should do as good.
What a picture. I could see the whole thing
as
you read it.
Yeah. I mean,
bonding experience.
The bonding experience. And, you know, the son grew up to be a poet and yet used those memories. I mean, I just love this, that there could be modern contemporary poetry about watching wrestling with your dad. I think that is just an awesome thing.
That's true love.
It is.
That's Terry Border. You'll be back again next week with another Poetry Throwdown. '93-year-old Keith Bratton doesn't let age or ailments or unappreciative peers get in the way of creating his art. Curious Mix contributor Joy Hernandez spent time with this highly creative and contagiously cheerful Indianapolis artist.
Let's talk about me now.
Keith Bratton is a master of deadpan humor. He's also an artist. He combines these two personality aspects to create his signature cut paper whimsical art.
It's hard to sell humor. Everybody has a different sense of humor. And some of it is belly laughs, and somebody creates some sort of thing like I did with hidden humor. But nobody that I know of does it. And I have more fun doing them than I think the people who buy them.
Bratton is 93 years old and clocked quite a career in advertising before retirement. On the day of this interview, he wore a bright orange Letterman sweater with KB for Keith Bratton Advertising sewn onto the side, a gift from his former staff.
It's the only varsity letter sweater in advertising.
Despite his distinguished career, Bratton found it hard to break into gallery life with his art.
I couldn't get in a gallery. They said that I was too commercial or people weren't buying funny stuff, and I'd never seen anything funny in a gallery anyway. Dave Manweiler used to do a column in the news, said that, well, Bratton's artwork will never be hung in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I went to New York. My daughter Kim lived in New York, and I thought I'd take a couple pictures and see if I could get them in a gallery in New York. So I took one to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and asked a guy if I could hang one in the restroom. And he said, I have to go through their public relations department and all those complications. All I want to do is hang it in the restroom. So I could get back at Manweiler by saying, ha, you said I'd never be displayed in the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Naysayers and jokes aside, Bratton finally got opportunities to show his art, first at his church and then at the Franklin Berry Gallery in Zionsville. He was very pleased when his humorous creations began to sell.
And a woman came by, he was telling me, and bought it, and she thought it was so funny that she laughed so hard she almost had an accident. And I thought, what other gallery features this type artwork that helps you with your biological functions?
Cutting shapes from paper and layering them on a page, Bratton creates scenes, a visual comedy leading to a punchline. He has two runners, each about to cross a finish line tape, but from different directions. One is finishing and one is winning, he says. Another scene has a weightlifter sweating with the anxiety of watching a little butterfly attempt to land on one of the weights, perhaps an ounce too far. Some scenes are based on his observations and some are rooted in his travels, back in Bratton's advertising days.
Yeah, well, one of my clients was manufactured housing, so I spent a lot of time up in Amish territory. And they have a pretty good sense of humor.
Bratton has a whimsical piece featuring an Amish painter applying hot rod flames to his friend's buggy, and another showing an Amish man stewing in the frustration of waiting for one last leaf to drop while raking. His love for the Amish extends to 3D work, faux products that he's designed. He holds up a little glass jar topped with a little felt hat and reads the label.
Essence Das Amish. And its fragrances are New Mode Hay, Wild Oats, and Apple Strudel. And the slogan is, it'll drive her buggy. Can you imagine an Amishman being interested in aftershave lotion? But I do a number of Amish things. I find them very pleasant people to be around.
In a time when dad jokes rule the internet, Bratton cuts granddad jokes, as sharp as his knife cutting paper. Given his recent health, it's impressive that Bratton retains his humor and his ability to cut intricate figures from paper.
Well, I had a stroke about 3 years ago, and my hands and my brain don't work the same. They're on different pages for some reason. So I'm still doing them.
Whether or not people get his jokes.
I've got a picture of a speedway, and there's a clown car with all these clowns driving, beating the real modern race car across the finish line. And she was overheard looking at it, and she's saying, is that supposed to be funny? And I don't understand why she would think that it wasn't funny with a car full of clowns.
Along the way, Bratton's art has touched people in some pretty high-ranking places, proving no matter how far you go, everyone can appreciate humor and whimsy.
A lady in Sacramento, California, had wanted a picture of her husband for a birthday present, and she said he was obsessed with hot dogs, and could I do one of him and hot dogs? And I said, well, yeah, I guess I can try. But so I did this picture, and she gave it to her husband, who, by the way, was one of President Reagan's bodyguards. A lady down the hall here, when I moved in, she bought 10 of my pictures, and she used to be on the staff of interior decorators at the White House in Washington, D.C. So I asked her if one of those pictures would be appropriate for the White House, and she said no.
One of Bratton's crowning achievements is a promotional poster he created for the 500 Festival. Rendered in his same cut paper technique, it features the motorcycle police starting off the festival parade with race cars and revelry, all of the markers of May, including the jet flyover. The shadows from the paper layers add dimension to the 2D print.
Got all of the events of the 500 Festival there. 50 cutout pieces. The thing, all my art is pretty much three-dimensional. There are some prints.
He's hidden the names of his children throughout the piece. At 93, Bratton keeps creating and keeps telling jokes. He's undeterred by his gallery experiences and feels he's found his place in the art world.
You think of cartoonists, you don't think of them as artists. Somehow, we who do whimsical type things are relegated to the bottom of the artistic scale. You go through a gallery, like I said, you seldom, if ever, see anybody smiling. I don't think Van Gogh did many funny pictures. I don't walk around with a smile on my face all the time, but the work that I turn out, I think, has some whimsy. Keep smiling, because the medical profession has discovered that laughing or smiling is good for you.
I'm Joy Hernandez for Curious Mix.
Given you plenty to hear this hour, but this next story requires your eyes.
Want to see some light from 11 million years ago? Here's how. I'm Matt Pelser, and this is your Weekend Sky Report. If you have a telescope, try spotting this popular target for amateur astronomers. M81, also known as Bode's Galaxy, is named after 18th century German astronomer Johann Bode, who discovered it on New Year's Eve, 1774. Of course, he didn't know it was a galaxy at the time. In fact, for a while, it was known as Bode's Nebula. Bode's Galaxy is a spiral galaxy 11.7 million light years from Earth, which means it lies outside of the local group of galaxies, galaxies within 5 million light years of the Milky Way. And the neat thing about Bode's Galaxy is that here in the Northern Hemisphere, above a certain latitude, it's always out. It never dips below the horizon. So that should give you a clue as to how to find it. If you've got a good view of the northern sky, find the Big Dipper. Now, depending on when you're observing, the Big Dipper may be on its side or upside down. Some of it might even be below the horizon. When you find it, imagine it's on its side with the handle to the left and the bowl to the right. Find the four stars that make the bowl and trace a diagonal line from the star on the bottom left of the bowl to the star on the top right of the bowl and extend that line about that same distance. Right around there is where you'll find Bode's Galaxy. Now, Bode's Galaxy isn't exactly bright. Depending on your telescope and your location, it probably won't look like much, especially if you're in the suburbs like me. But I've seen it from my house, so I know you can too. If you find it, you'll be looking at a galaxy just about as big as our own galaxy, the Milky Way. I'm Matt Pelser. Happy skywatching.
Brandon Meeks composed and performs our music. And this Curious Mix was created by
Terry Border,
Roxana Caldwell,
Sarah Neil Estes,
Gary Harrison,
Rick Brewer,
Kyle Long,
Joy Hernandez,
Chris Siegel,
Matt Pelser,
Bob Williams,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.